Today is the last day of play in the British Open on the old course at St. Andrews in Scotland. I once took the overnight train from Euston Station in London to Inverness, Scotland. It passed through St. Andrews at dawn. Seeing the naturally manicured landscape, I understood why golf is and has always been popular here. These are the greens that course designers the world over try to copy. Historians say golf has been played at St. Andrews for more than five centuries. A much maligned 16th century monarch loved the sport as well as the spot. In her Washington Post column this past week, Sally Jenkins writes that Mary Stuart, who was beheaded in 1587 by her rival Elizabeth I, kept a cottage at St. Andrews, and the Queen of Scots was an avid golfer. She bestowed a necklace to her lady-in-waiting after losing a match. She's thought to have originated the term caddy, and she was ridiculed for playing around just a few days after her husband, the English Lord Darnley, was strangled. That golf game came back to haunt her. In 1568, Mary was forced to flee to England, where murder charges were brought against her. Her accuser said the fact that she went out on the links instead of staying in to mourn her husband was evidence of her guilt. She spent the rest of her life in prison and eventually was denied all forms of exercise. There's a golf museum in St. Andrews, and a portrait of Mary, Queen of Scots, hangs on the wall. A small, posthumous tribute to the woman known as the mother of golf. You're listening to NPR News.
Just as the Civil War was coming to an end, a young Scottish journeyman from Glasgow arrived on a ship to New York. His name was Tommy Lipton, and when he came to America, he was like thousands of other recent arrivals, penniless and anonymous. And in New York,
Lipton found a busy street lined with cheap hotels, cheaper flophouses, and saloons catering to sailors and other transients. Poles hung with dozens of telegraph wires marched down the avenues and cross streets, casting shadows and cross-hatching the sky. The air smelled of rotting garbage, horse manure, and the acrid smoke from the tall chimneys of a big soap factory that occupied several buildings a block away.
That's Michael D'Antonio reading from his new biography of Tommy Lipton. The young Glaswegian would spend 5 years in America doing odd jobs and taking mental notes before returning to Scotland to found his tea empire, Lipton Teas. Michael D'Antonio's book is called A Full Cup, and he joins me from our studios in New York. Welcome.
Great to be with you.
Now, before we get to how Tommy Lipton would become Thomas J. Lipton, one of the most famous tea merchants in history, let's start with that trip to America. It's 1864. He's 17 years old, and he comes to America. What was he looking to do? What was he looking to find out?
He came to see that in someone like P.T. Barnum, in the men who brought cows and horses and set up a rodeo in what is now Harlem, in A.T. Stewart, who was the great merchant of the time, these examples of people who could get an idea, piece things together and present it to the world for profit or loss and take great big risks.
Now, we should mention that Lipton's family had a small grocery shop back in Glasgow. When Tommy Lipton was in the U.S., what was he learning about the way Americans ran businesses?
He learned that it was far better to scrub up your little store and light it brightly and display your goods with some flair than to try to hide the flaws in your merchandise and pass it off as first-rate goods. And oddly enough, that was the style of retailing in Glasgow at the time when he started out for America. Most of the shops where people bought food had a dismal variety. Mm. You know, you'd go in and there'd be a shipment of 3 dozen eggs for that morning, and when the eggs were gone, And if you went to a disreputable grocer, he would give you something left over from the day before that might be spoiled, and you wouldn't discover it until you got home. And in America, he found these places where the offerings were varied, but also well-lit. People actually enjoyed shopping. It wasn't considered a terrible chore, and you didn't have to fight with the merchant over the price and the quality of the goods.
After 5 years in the U.S., Lipton returns to Glasgow, to his home, in 1870. A year later, he opens the first branch of Lipton's Market, and it becomes a huge success, like almost overnight. What made it different?
Well, for one thing, Lipton had fun. This was a guy who put concave and convex mirrors outside the store so you could look at yourself as a fat man and a skinny man. In the morning, you might follow a parade of pigs that he had arranged.
You wrote that sometimes he hired a dozen overweight men and then a dozen very, very thin men on opposite sides of the streets. They would march down holding placards, one side saying, going to Lipton's, the other side. They were holding signs saying, coming from Lipton's.
Oh, absolutely. It was a good thing to be kind of rotund back then. It meant you were a person of wealth and you were well-fed. And so it was a combination of the quality of the goods and the lighting. Now, this is a funny thing to think about. It gets dark very early in the day in the winters in Glasgow.
And anybody who's been there knows that at 2 o'clock, it's dusk.
And he was a fellow who decided to spend money on gas. So he had many, many light fixtures installed in his store. You could turn the corner and look down the street, and the only thing you might really notice is Lipton's shop.
Wow. Of course, he expands. He sees. He becomes a fairly wealthy man. That's when he decides to get into tea. You write that sort of around the 1880s, the average Briton was drinking 35 gallons of tea a year. Why did he decide to get into tea if he was already successful in the food business?
In the 1870s and 1880s, tea was a very unreliable product. You could go into a market and have your tea measured out and get home and discover that half of it is spoiled. Mm. It would have a terrible taste. They actually recycled tea. There were scavengers who would go by cafes and restaurants and hotels in the afternoons and collect the used tea from the morning.
And then resell it.
and then resell it.
Right.
They might mix it with some fresh leaves. Lipton saw here also that there was a monopoly in a place called Mincing Lane. Wonderful name. Mm. Mincing Lane was really the middleman for all the tea sold in Great Britain. He decided that he could match Mincing Lane and he could beat them. And he did. He really developed the first consistent brand of tea that was the same from package to package, from location to location, every time you bought it. And he priced it at half the price of other manufacturers. And so it was a runaway hit.
The other side of your book has an entirely separate side, which is really about Lipton's celebrity. He was sort of, a kind of a Richard Branson meets Larry Ellison of the early 20th century. After he becomes famous, rich, successful, he's knighted and so on, he decides to enter probably the most prestigious sailing competition, the America's Cup. For the first time in 1899, he does it five more times. First of all, why did he decide to do this?
This is something that today escapes most of us. But in 1899, it wasn't the World Series that people followed. People waited for these great yachting competitions because they were not only sporting events, but they were contests of technology. It was literally America and America's science, America's engineering, America's industry versus Great Britain.
He competed, about five times between 1899 and 1930?
Five times. Each time he lost, each time he won more love and more affection from the American public. And I think it was because he represented every immigrant who ever came to America, every poor boy who ever wanted to make it. He came from tougher beginnings than we can even imagine today. He grew up in a slum that Friedrich Engels called the worst industrial neighborhood in the world. Uneducated, he came to America, learned how to become someone else, went back to Great Britain and did it. and had such style, had such grace and humor that the Americans loved him. So he was the guy standing up for every Irishman and every Scot and eventually every Italian and every Jew, whoever came and tried to make it in a tough place. So every time he lost, he actually won.
That's Michael D'Antonio, author of A Full Cup, Sir Thomas Lipton's Extraordinary Life and His Quest for the America's Cup. Michael, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Implementing the financial reform bill isn't the only big task looming for the federal government. In the next year, the government needs to fill an estimated 50,000 entry-level positions. This past week, recruiters from 85 federal agencies set up shop at a job fair in Washington, D.C. NPR's Carolyn Beeler was there, along with more than 7,000 people looking for work.
Carolyn Basala is standing in a line that snakes around one of the massive columns at the National Building Museum. She arrived in Washington, D.C. from Arizona just hours before the job fair began.
I got an email on Monday, actually, saying, hey, there's a career fair. It's the largest federal career fair ever. So I made very last-minute arrangements, hopped on a plane last night, flew 12 hours, and changed planes three times.
That's dedication, or as Basala calls it, desperation. With a 9.5% unemployment rate, lots of people have been feeling that desperation. Basala has been waiting in line to talk to the CIA for 45 minutes. She's holding a folder filled with copies of her resume, and she's wearing one of the three work dresses she found a couple months ago.
I bought them all because I figured I should build my work wardrobe a little bit before I get a job. I just never thought I'd have this much time to build it.
Basala graduated from the University of Arizona in December, and she's applied for about 70 government jobs. She wants to use her background in Middle Eastern studies to work in intelligence, and she knows she wants to work for the federal government.
Because it's such a stable job and has great salary and great benefits, I mean, it's appealing.
A lot of people at the job fair say the most important thing is that with the government, there are jobs.
How are you doing, sir? My name is Taj Glenn.
Taj?
Yes.
Nice to meet you.
And I'm crazy about the environment.
Taj Glenn is talking to a recruiter from the Environmental Protection Agency. He also visited the Postal Service booth and plans on talking to some recruiters in the healthcare field. When I asked him what his dream job is, his answer was more practical than aspirational.
My dream job is a job that's going to keep me financially stable and that's going to keep the bills paid.
There was a time when young people dreamed of jobs with big bonuses. In the 1987 movie Wall Street, the character Gordon Gekko told people that making money was the ultimate goal.
Greed, for lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works.
Today, many people are saying that a regular paycheck is what works. Max Steyer is the head of the Partnership for Public Service, the nonprofit that organized the job fair.
The federal government, unlike an internet startup, better not go bust. So we need our federal government to survive and thrive, and in that sense, it's definitely stable.
Entry-level hiring in the federal government has been steadily increasing over the past 5 years as the oldest baby boomers begin to retire.
The government has the oldest workforce of any sector and therefore will experience the baby boom retirement wave earlier and faster than any of the other sectors.
As job openings increase, though, so will applications. The online process for applying for a federal job is being revamped to make it easier, and that's expected to increase application numbers even more. Carolyn Beeler, NPR News, Washington.
The massive oil spill is taking a toll on the people who live and work along the Gulf Coast. Mike Voisin and his family have an oyster business in Houma, Louisiana. He's also the past president of National Fisheries Institute.
There are some challenges, and I'm hoping, you know, last week we had some openings of recreational fishing here in Louisiana. About 86% of Louisiana opened up. We're hoping soon we can get the commercial areas opened up as well, and we still have about 50% of the commercial operations open. So with that, we still produce a lot of seafood products down here. And people need to be aware of that. They need to know that it's being tested.
That testing is being carried out by the U.S. government. Three federal agencies are working to make sure seafood coming from the Gulf Coast waters is safe. Teams of sniffers have been trained to root out tainted seafood and to help determine when waters close to fishing can be reopened. NPR's Kathy Lohr has more.
John Stein is head of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's inspection program. He says with all the technology available, one of the most effective tools for sensing tainted seafood is still your nose.
And if you think about your ability to detect something in your refrigerator, it has an off odor, you can detect at very, very low levels.
State employees and professors, 56 of them, who live along the Gulf Coast, have been called into sniffing duty. The FDA and NOAA conduct training for these people who are the first line of defense.
I'm Lucina Lampilla. I'm an associate professor with Louisiana State University. We are in a food processing lab here in the Food Science Building.
Lampilla is one of the local sniffers, and she set up a test for us. Covered glass casseroles sit on a table. Some contain corn, cucumbers, and watermelon. These are just cleansing agents. Others hold raw shrimp. We open a lid and take what Lampilla describes as small bunny sniffs.
Really fresh seafood, the typical consumer shouldn't be able to smell much of anything.
But when we test a bowl of shrimp that Lampilla tainted with a small amount of ammonia, it's pungent and putrid.
It smells bad, and it's decomposition aroma of that. Ooh, I didn't want to use the actual oil with some of the volatile hydrocarbons that are in there just for safety purposes.
These screeners don't have to determine what type of contamination is in the samples, whether that's oil, dispersant, or something else. They only detect whether a sample is normal by testing it against a baseline of seafood caught before the spill.
Believe me, I don't believe someone would go ahead and attempt to eat something that is tainted because it is very aromatic and it's quite unpleasant.
Here's how the testing process works. Seafood samples are collected from the boundaries of areas where fishing is closed. The newly trained sniffers take a whiff. And if the seafood passes muster, it goes to a panel of 7 expert inspectors in Pascagoula, Mississippi. The experts can detect a tiny bit of contamination, 1 part per million. Newer state screeners, up to 10 parts per million. That's a single drop in a gallon of water. Steve Wilson is NOAA's chief quality officer. He participated in the training.
You have known experts who are in the room who, in fact, can help direct the trainees towards this is the sort of smell you should be getting. You might get it in your tongue. You might get it in the back of your nasal cavity. You might feel it right here.
NOAA officials are on high alert to prevent any seafood containing oil from being caught and sold. In addition to using sniffers, the agency sends hundreds of samples to a lab in Seattle for chemical analysis. So far, just one sample came back tainted. NOAA's Steve Wilson.
Even though it may be safe to consume, if you smell oil, people won't want to buy fish, and so the market gets depressed as well.
One of the largest markets in Louisiana is Tony's Seafood in Baton Rouge, where Bill Pizzolatto is one of the owners.
We just have an assortment of different kinds of fish, catfish, freshwater, buffalo and goo, different varieties of fish, farm-raised fish, redfish out of Texas. Then we have shrimp.
Blue crabs and crawfish are big right now, coming in fresh daily, where they're inspected and sorted on a conveyor belt. Pizzolatto says he now has lots of frozen seafood on hand, fish caught in the months before the spill. His father started this market 50 years ago, and he says he knows the locals here who have continually monitored the spill and the areas open for fishing.
We try to be sure that our seafood is safe and knowing the source where it comes from, and just try to just take it and hopefully we can get through all this and get by.
People in Louisiana and along the Gulf are still buying and eating seafood. The problem is, with so much oil in the water, many across the country are wary of fish caught here. But NOAA officials say the seafood that gets to market is safe. Kathy Lohr, NPR News.
There's a new college starting classes this summer in Berkeley, California. It's called Zaytuna College, and its motto is Where Islam Meets America. It's the first Muslim college in the United States, and its very existence brings up questions and controversy. Reporter Lonnie Shavelson has our story.
It's a pretty standard California college scene. Students walk across a sunny courtyard into classrooms, pick seats next to friends. But then, the women sit on opposite sides of the auditorium from the men, who are mostly heavily bearded, heads covered in skullcaps. Only one woman's hair is visible. The rest wear modest Islamic scarves. The language is Arabic. They're offering summer language classes in preparation for an official fall opening. Hardly news, you might think, since the U.S. is filled with religious colleges. But
Muslim scholars launching the first ever four-year accredited Muslim college in the United States of America.
But is this controversial school being set up to educate or indoctrinate young Americans?
What I call the stealth jihad in America, Islam's insinuating itself into our academic institutions.
That's Fox News. Their main criticism of the college has to do with the teachings of one of the founders, Sheikh Hamza Yusuf. He's an American convert to Islam and a kind of celebrity preacher of rock star proportions. His opposition to the U.S. war in the Middle East has drawn much of the incoming fire against the college. Here he is on Al Jazeera English.
When you have states that bomb people, you're going to have people that are at the brunt of those bombs. They're going to be very upset. Somehow we legitimize state terror, and then vigilante terror is demonized.
But another founder of the school, Imam Zaid Shakir, says Zaytuna's goal is to teach a diversity of opinions, not preach a single answer.
I think you hear things that, oh, these people, they're radicals, they're going to teach fundamentalism or things of that nature.
Imam Shakir says the voices of opposition to the college are a U.S. minority opinion, responding to an Islamic minority.
Because you see these foiled bomb plots, a lunatic fringe. And I think this is why Zaytuna College is so important. If we prove ourselves, even those more vocal critics will be silenced. It's up to us. The ball is in our court.
Holding that ball are Zaytuna's incoming students, who find themselves not only studying at Zaytuna, but defending it.
Islamophobia is so entrenched at this point in this country that for Muslims to do anything at this point, there's some level of defense that has to take place. That's not to say that we should have to defend ourselves.
Dustin Cron is a 30-year-old convert to Islam. He's already gained a bachelor's degree, but that, he says, missed something. So he enrolled at this Islamic college.
The beauty of Islamic knowledge is that it balances between the mind and the heart and the soul.
His professor, Imam Shakir, says another balance at Zaytuna is with American and Muslim culture. Most teachers of Islam in America, he says, have come from other countries. So even though there are millions of American Muslims, the religion seems foreign here. But teachers at Zaytuna, he says, will be people like him.
People who are trained and educated right here, who understand the nuances and complexities of our society, and who also are comfortable with their Americanness on the one hand and comfortable with Islam on the other hand.
Many of the students at Zaytuna are, like Imam Shakir, converts to Islam. Take Monica Hernandez of mixed Mexican, Irish, Italian heritage. She found Islam when she was 13. Now 24, she says Zaytuna is the first school she's attended where she can
practice Islam and at the same time be American. And that's really the essence of this religion, is being true to yourself.
Classes this fall for Zaytuna College's first 14 students include legal issues in the Quran, Islamic business law, American constitutional law, and English composition. For NPR News, I'm Lonnie Shavelson.